oil slips and European stocks slide.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura, in for David Brancaccio. Right now, the FT 100 index in London is down 0.2%. It's at 6,377. Across Europe, investors are worried about falling oil prices. They're also of concern to U.S. investors. The major market indices here all closed down yesterday. Justin Urquhart Stewart is director and co-founder of Seven Investment Management. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
So there are a lot of competing factors here driving stocks down in Europe. Is oil the biggest one?
It is, but of course it's backed up by a lot of other issues as well, not least of which, of course, the concerns as to what might be happening with regard to Greece. And then also tomorrow we have another issue for the Eurozone coming up, which is going to be their figures on inflation, which might prove that actually they're heading for the first quarter of deflation. But just as a background to it, the oil price has actually given a shock for it, even though actually for most of the Eurozone, a lower oil price should be better for those economies.
There is so much concern in Europe about deflation, and I wonder how these oil prices fit into that. Is it symptomatic? Is it a sign that there could be worse things around the corner? How do you process it?
The issue is going to be one of the Eurozone actually finding itself with low growth, low returns, and low inflation. Now, the European Central Bank has been trying to repair the banking system, just as you've seen in the States. But even if you get the banking system properly working, the actual demand from consumers is still relatively low. What you've got is this sort of European souffle, which a few years ago looked beautifully baked coming out of the oven. Unfortunately, now has sunk into a looking like a rather sodden dish. So the Eurozone now questioning actually how it's going to be able to get out of this without significant quantitative easing and how it actually gets consumer confidence and demand back.
Justin Urquhart Stewart is director and co-founder of Seven Investment Management. Justin, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Soon, instead of swiping our credit cards, we'll dip them into new smart chip readers. Stores will need to install new credit card machines by October. Credit card companies are already mailing out new upgraded cards, but as Dan Bobkoff reports, some cards are better than others.
All chip cards are a big improvement over the magnetic stripes. The chips generate a different code with each transaction, making it virtually impossible to counterfeit cards, says Julie Comroy of Ite Group.
Without that dynamic code, the issuers know that this isn't their card, and they would decline the transaction.
Counterfeiting is the biggest drain on the industry, $3 billion a year in losses, according to Ite. But not all chip cards in the U.S. will work the same way. With some, we'll still sign a receipt. Others will have a PIN code, like an ATM. That helps prevent another kind of fraud, someone stealing your card and forging your signature. But that's a much smaller problem in the industry, so the majority of American issuers are skipping the PIN. Randy Vanderhoof heads the industry group, the EMV Migration Forum. He says switching to PINs would be a big deal for people.
It would create some additional challenges with them remembering their PINs and using the cards correctly at the point of sale.
And no one wants to be the person fumbling at the register. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Late last year, a court in Kansas ruled that public schools are so underfunded they violate the state's constitution. Lawsuits like that one have become a popular way to try to win more money for public schools. 13 states face active litigation, from Texas to Pennsylvania. But even when these lawsuits are successful, they don't always work, as Amy Scott reports from the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore.
The ruling in Kansas means the legislature could have to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars for public schools. Shelley Kiblinger is superintendent of schools in Hutchinson, a small city in south central Kansas. Her district is one of several that sued the state.
Class sizes have gone up. We've either not been able to hire staff that we need, or we've had to let staff go. At one point, we had three school resource officers in our district. We now struggle to have one.
More money isn't on the way yet. The state is expected to appeal. An earlier case in Kansas led the state legislature to increase funding for schools, only to cut it back during the recent recession. Michael Griffith is a school finance consultant with the Education Commission of the States, a nonpartisan policy group. He says in other states like Ohio, court victories haven't always led to better funding.
Even when the rulings are in favor of the school districts, you don't necessarily see the changes that most people would anticipate.
That's partly because of battles between courts and state lawmakers. The Supreme Court in Washington state has threatened to shut down the public schools or fine legislators if they don't come up with increased funding. In Kansas, Griffith says the state doesn't have the money, and the only way to increase education spending would be to raise taxes.
And I think there would be a huge amount of reluctance in the state of Kansas to do that.
Then there's the question of whether more money leads to better schools. After its own court battles, Wyoming now spends more on education per student than any other state, but student achievement still lags. Michael Rebell with the Campaign for Educational Equity says money alone doesn't fix schools.
Money does matter if it's used well. Without it, you can't make progress, especially when we're talking about kids from low-income, high-poverty backgrounds.
And with schools enrolling more kids than ever with special needs, he says the cost of educating them is just getting higher. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Finally, TV networks sell ads based on how many viewers they have, and for decades, many of them have relied on ratings from a company called Nielsen. The financial network CNBC was one of Nielsen's customers, but it's decided to take its business elsewhere. CNBC's president says Nielsen has never measured us accurately. The company only surveys households. It's not checking to see who's watching TV at the office, where most people watch wall-to-wall coverage of the stock market. Our producers are Justin Ho, Katie Long, and Meg Kramer. In Washington, I'm David Gura with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.